Welcome to the View My Seats podcast with John Lord, a series of conversations on sports and culture with various fans, friends, and media personalities. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or by visiting viewmyseats.com. Thanks for listening. Travis Waldron from thinkprogress.org. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for reaching out.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to start actually with something that's in the news today, which is the protests going on in Baltimore. You've written extensively about that the last few days, and I'm wondering what your take is exactly on if sports has any kind of role in potentially diffusing the current situation in Baltimore. You know, that there's going to have to be something done here this week because the mayor has placed a curfew in the city, and they're not going to be able to play their games at night at Camden Yards, and they have night games scheduled for most of the week and during this homestand. So the chief operating officer, John Angelos, came out, I think, a couple of days ago and spoke rather passionately about how the situation in Baltimore is larger than what's going on in Camden Yards. I'm wondering what your take is as a journalist, as a sports writer. Do you see the team, the Orioles, potentially having any role in possibly diffusing the tension, or is it much, much bigger than anything baseball can do?
Well, I think it depends on how you look at their role. I think they certainly have a role, because I think sports play such a huge role in communities like this. And, you know, Camden Yards is a kind of an iconic place in Baltimore for people who aren't there, who don't know the city. So it's kind of, you know, it's a flashpoint for people when the protests get there. I think Angelos's comments are really interesting, and I wrote about them yesterday, and I think they provide kind of a context for this that a lot of people don't necessarily think of, and they reframe this in a way that people don't necessarily think of the fact that, you know, that this isn't a one-off event. This isn't a, you know, one guy was killed, one thing happened, now we're going to protest. There's a lot of factors that go into that, economic factors, racial factors, obviously, and a lot of buildup. And I think, you know, if you look at the past of Baltimore with the amount of police brutality that has been documented there, or the economic problems that have been documented there, it goes into that. And I think for an executive of a baseball team, of a team that is so, you know, obviously closely tied to that community, to come out and kind of put that perspective on it is very interesting, and can have an impact if people listen. And I think the same thing can be said for the team itself. I think when you see guys like Adam Jones saying, you know, that they're paying attention, that this is something that's affecting them, that they're members of the community, that as an African American, you know, he's particularly interested in it, and that, you know, he's someone who does charity work and is closely tied to the community. I think it can have somewhat of an impact. That said, I think, you know, I think the key part of what John Angelos said too is that this is much bigger than baseball. There's only so much they can do. You know, they can stand up, they can say things, they can express their views on it, the same way that LeBron James and Derrick Rose and, you know, NFL players did around other instances of this in Ferguson, Missouri, or in Staten Island, New York, or elsewhere. They can have an impact by saying that. I think, though, you know, it is worth remembering that this is much larger than the sport itself, and that, you know, whatever inconveniences this poses to Baltimore Orioles fans, the Baltimore Orioles, the Chicago White Sox, or Major League Baseball itself, are, as Angelos said, pretty irrelevant compared to the larger societal questions at hand. And I think it's worth remembering, you know, sports love to talk about how much of an impact they can have, but it's also worth remembering that sometimes when they get impacted by events like this, that it's not nearly as significant, and it's not nearly as big of a problem as the other things, the larger questions. So it's worth keeping in that context. You know, if the Orioles have to move to DC for a week, or if they have to play day games for a week, yeah, it's a little inconveniencing, but it's not a problem on the order of addressing the bigger problems in Baltimore and elsewhere.
But I think what Angelo said is so refreshing, because it's not often that you hear team executives speak out on very important social and political issues. You know, it doesn't it's not always in their best financial interest to take a stand. But here you have a top executive making a very poignant comment about how there are larger issues at play here in Baltimore than the team he represents, the Baltimore Orioles. And I find that very refreshing. And it's something that, you know, we're not accustomed to as sports fans. You know, it seems to be that sports figures take the easier road often when it comes to voicing their opinions on very important issues. And what Angelo said is layered with all sorts of history and important ideas. But the fact that he said it is what matters to me.
100%. I think that's correct. I think we've gotten to a point where it's less shocking now when the athletes do it. We've seen LeBron, we've seen Derrick Rose and the four guys from the St. Louis Rams. You know, those are guys where both because of their race, because they come from economic backgrounds that are similar to a lot of the people involved. They come or much closer to a lot of the people involved than someone like John Angelos. You know, so we kind of expect and maybe even demand a little bit of it from them to have kind of a consciousness of their communities. But I think, you know, we should have that same expectation of sports owners and executives too. They're always fond of touting their connection to community when it's beneficial to them. When they need, you know, stadium money or when they need, you know, public support for something. But to see them come out and to see John Angelos come out and tout that connection to the community and to show an understanding of the deeper problems that have plagued that community for a long time is, as you said, very refreshing. I think it's something that was almost a little shocking. I think that's why it got the reaction that it got, because you know, we don't see executives coming out that way and really taking a stand on something that maybe isn't directly in their benefit. You know, I think if you're the Baltimore Orioles, you have a stake, obviously, in kind of law and order and peace and order around your stadium. And he showed a level of understanding for why this is happening, for the deeper meaning and attitudes and frustrations behind why this is happening that, you know, as you said, we don't often see from the people in charge.
And Camden Yards is part of this larger revitalization project in Baltimore in the Inner Harbor. And it, you know, it's a really a beautiful part of town. And as a fan who goes to visit the stadium and the tourist attractions in the Inner Harbor, you're led to believe that Baltimore is in a much better economic and social political position than it really is. And I think what's so scary to a lot of fans of the sport of baseball is that it kind of makes you feel somewhat ignorant, that you weren't more aware of the current temperature in Baltimore as far as the more important issues that are plaguing that city: police brutality, gentrification, socioeconomic division. These things have always existed in Baltimore, but as a baseball fan, we haven't always seen those things, because when we go to Baltimore, we go to beautiful Camden Yards, we walk around the Inner Harbor, so we're not really led to believe what life is actually like on the ground there. So I think for me, as an Orioles fan, which I am, as also a baseball fan, this is very disheartening for several reasons. Number one, because it represents a really a tragic occurrence that is all too common, unfortunately, in Baltimore and other places around the country. But also it changes the way that you view a city that you've kind of come to love for things that may or may not be true.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's a problem. That's an issue in multiple cities, in a lot of cities around the country. You know, Camden Yards was kind of the first of the new wave of ballparks that moved back downtown, or not just moved back downtown, but kind of integrated into the community around them. And, you know, none of these problems exist in isolation. None of these things exist in a vacuum. And, you know, like you said, that the Camden Yards, the revitalization of downtown Baltimore are all factors. I mean, I think if you look around, you know, I saw some people tweeting pictures last night of, here's the damage that protests have done to West Baltimore, but here are empty buildings. Here are buildings with glass broken out that have been vacant for a decade, or or longer, you know, this is what our policies have done to Baltimore. This is what, you know, revitalization in parts and ignoring of other parts has done to Baltimore. And I think that's a, you know, it's easy from here in D.C. to get on the train, go to Camden Yards, or go to the football stadium, or go to the Inner Harbor, and never really have to interact with the rest of the city. You know, you kind of see Baltimore, you kind of see the face of the Baltimore that Baltimore politicians and developers and everyone else wants you to see, and it's a beautiful picture. But there is so much more out there beyond that, obviously. And, you know, I think it's, you know, as some people wrote, that that's sort of kind of the downside of locking people into the stadium the other night is, you know, that kind of frees them. And it's understandable that, you know, the city has a stake in keeping people safe and everything around the stadium. But it also kind of insulates them from having to see the other side and to see what has happened and to see these bigger issues that are going on, you know, in their neighborhood, right down the street. It's, you know, it's not a faraway place. It's right there and right outside the ballpark. And I think it was interesting, you know, to see on that first night of protests when they kind of moved toward the ballpark. And that's when some of the riot gear came out from the police and to say that, you know, oh, they'll protect the Orioles and they'll protect this part of the community. Why won't they protect our part of the community? Why won't they protect us the same way they protect baseball fans? And I think that's a, you know, kind of a, it's something that, you know, again, goes into that deeper consideration of sports kind of give you a lens on some of these problems, but that there's so many more deeper considerations and the way that sports and our teams and our stadiums and our athletes interact with the communities around them can show you these big problems, but they also shouldn't, you know, hopefully in theory shouldn't shield you from those big problems.
Yeah, but there was nothing more symbolic as far as how certain people can be shielded by those problems than than the decision to close the Camden Yards to essentially lock the haves from the have-nots. It was a really, really frightening moment as an American, not just a sports fan, but you've got almost this eerie scene from a movie taking place right before our very eyes, where you have the better half being taken care of by a group, the Baltimore police, that is under considerable scrutiny, and justifiably so, for what has been happening, certainly in jails and in the death of Freddie Gray. So it was, for me, I'm sure for a lot of Americans, it was the symbol of a lot of unrest, division, socioeconomic inequality, and being shielded from that socioeconomic inequality is very scary.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, a big thing that people have written. And, you know, there's been so much talk of the violent protests, but a lot of a huge segment of the protests have been peaceful and nonviolent and have just tried to raise attention about these issues. And yeah, there is an element of, you know, when you lock people in the ballpark, you're shielding them from that. You're shielding them from the problems that exist in their community. And it's kind of a catch-22, I guess. You know, I can see the justifications for locking down the ballpark, for wanting to keep people safe, for not wanting to cause further confrontations between baseball fans and the people protesting, because I think we've seen, you know, outside of St. Louis's ballpark in last fall when they taunted. Mike Brown protesters with racial taunts and with, you know, the idea that go get a job or what you're doing isn't helping or everything like that. And, you know, there's two sides of this and both of them are kind of justifiable, but I do, you know, totally think that, you know, shielding people from this is not the answer. I think they need to, you know, we need to see this. We need to hear the problems of other people in the community and address them. I think that's the only way we can address them.
Yeah, and what's so scary about Ferguson now, Travis, is that last year we thought that Ferguson was an isolated event, right? That this was perhaps a St. Louis problem. clearly it is not just a St. Louis problem. You know, you look across urban areas throughout this country, there are racial, ethnic, socioeconomic issues that are at play in so many urban areas across this country. So it's not just, it wasn't just a St. Louis issue. It's not just a Baltimore issue. There's nothing to say that this won't continue to happen in baseball cities across America, which makes me wonder, does Major League Baseball as a larger entity, not just individual teams, but does Major League Baseball as a larger entity have some sort of role to play in fostering real progress in cities where there are baseball teams?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's not just a St. Louis problem or a Baltimore problem. You know, it's an American problem. It's happening in Cleveland. It's happened in Oklahoma, South Carolina. We keep seeing these happening everywhere. And I think, you know, Adam Jones kind of touched on that in his comments, you know, that it can happen in any city. It's you know, I think he said African-American is an African-American in these cities. You know, whether how baseball can have a role, I don't know. You know, it's a complicated question. I think that, you know, baseball obviously has its own issues that are well publicized with connecting to African-American communities that it's trying to address. I hesitate to try to give Major League Baseball too much of a role in this, because I think, you know, it's the major problem is that the justice system has a role in this. The justice system, law enforcement, society writ large have to fix this problem. It's well beyond the scope of Major League Baseball. I think it's sort of akin to looking at the NFL and saying that the NFL can fix our domestic violence problems. You certainly want them to take some sort of role, and certainly want them to take some sort of action and doing things that help people and help communities and that don't see communities or their cities solely as piles of money that they can use to generate revenue and profit. But, you know, when it comes to fixing all of these problems, I don't think it's something that, you know, we shouldn't stop at saying, well, Major League Baseball needs to do this, because I think we all need to do it. I think our cities and our political elites and our justice system and our law enforcement elites, they need to take a role in this. They need to, you know, these problems are so big and so widespread that it's going to take a lot of different actors playing the proper role in reforming it. And so it's hard for me to say or to know how exactly baseball can address it, and how they can do it. But, you know, I think there's certainly ways it can intertwine with other things they're trying to do on this front. And, you know, they, like I said before, you know, they always talk about how they're members of the community when it benefits them. If they want to take a role in things like this, they should probably figure out more ways that they can be actual members of the community when it doesn't have a direct benefit to them.
Yeah, and I think the answer, clearly, as you were alluding to, is that the issue is simply just bigger than what Major League Baseball can or cannot accomplish. But I do like the small little gestures and steps taken by going full circle here back to what John Angelo said and also what Adam Jones said. You know, I think for players, popular players like Adam Jones, popular African-American players like Adam Jones to come out and say that, yeah, you know, this is an injustice, that this needs to be dealt with. However, just please be safe. You know, I think that when athletes speak out, you know, I don't know if there does make a difference, but symbolically, I feel that there is there's a lot of those athletes carry a lot of power with their words. And so I like the fact that Adam Jones, the most recognizable player on the team, came out and said what he did.
Yes, agreed. And, you know, I think they have a platform. I think for the athletes, for John Angelos, for the teams and for Major League Baseball itself to have a role in this is certainly something they can do. By saying it's larger than them, I don't absolve them from taking any role in it. I just think that,
correct,
you know, we can't stop there and say, yep, you know, what can Major League Baseball do to address this? The same way that we can't stop and say, well, if Roger Goodell in the NFL will take domestic violence more seriously, or if You know, if the sports world will openly accept gay athletes, then everything will be fine on those fronts. You know, that the sports world, for all the significance we give it, is still only one segment of society, and it is, I think, more often than not, a reflection of society rather than a kind of total driver for change, even accounting for the times when, you know, they have been out front on things.
Well, it certainly raises awareness, and it makes us it shouldn't make people feel guilty, but it certainly raises a certain self-awareness, level of ignorance that many of us feel, I think, at this point, to just accept that this is normal in so many places across this country. And for that, I'm hopeful that things can be done to change things for the better. I'm not overly optimistic. I do worry that this type of violence will continue to happen in other places across the country, and it will, unfortunately. But hopefully this can start to bring about some slow change.
Right, definitely.
The reason I wanted to initially have this conversation with you was that last week you wrote a very insightful piece on high school athletics and specifically gender parity in high school sports, how for girls of color there really is a major problem as far as access to sports, to athletic competition. Do you want to explain a little bit how Title IX hasn't yet achieved parity in high school sports, especially for girls of color?
Sure. So there was a report from the National Women's Law Center and another group that detailed that at heavily minority schools, girls of color are receiving a fraction of the opportunities to play sports as basically every other group. You know, they're receiving fewer opportunities than the boys at heavily minority schools. They're receiving a strikingly fewer number of opportunities than boys and girls at predominantly white schools. You know, I think we've seen with Title IX that it's been a very successful policy. 40 years in, we are closer to gender parity in sports than we ever have been. It's increased the number of opportunities for girls of all races tremendously, but it hasn't gotten us 100% of the way there for girls writ large, for white girls, or especially for girls of color. And I think this actually ties in. If you look at the report, it kind of ties into that larger societal problem conversation that we were having, because the way they did this study was based on heavily minority schools, which were classified as at least 90% minority, versus heavily white schools, which were at least 90% white. And, you know, the level of segregation that exists in the education system is a big issue here. And the schools that are heavily minority tend to get less funding for extracurricular and academics, both. So when they have that, they have fewer opportunities for sports in general. And when they do that, they have, more of those opportunities are going to boys than girls. So it kind of plays back into the segregation of communities, the segregation of school systems, the disparity of funding in school systems, and in school, just in single school districts for, schools that are in poorer communities than other schools in their own district. And, you know, it's a problem that is not solely we need to give these girls more opportunities. It even goes larger than that to how do we bring funding more equal? How do we give everybody equal opportunities no matter what school they go to? But it's a huge problem because, you know, not only has Title IX been successful in giving opportunities to girls, multiple studies have shown that those opportunities, those athletic opportunities at the high school level, have lifelong benefits, economic and health benefits for girls who participate in sports at the high school level. So it's something that we really need to address, and it will continue to be a problem going forward.
And it totally ties into what's plaguing Baltimore right now. I mean, the connection there is really kind of eerie as far as you're talking about inner city schools, which are grossly underfunded because a lot of the money left those urban areas decades ago and brought their higher tax brackets out to the kind of the beltway that surrounds Baltimore. And so a lot of those schools that remain in the city of Baltimore are underfunded and can't support programs, not just academic, but athletic programs as well. And you mentioned here how empowering athletics can be for young people. When you're dealing with schools that are underfunded, some of the first things that are cut are athletic sports programs. And to not have those opportunities for men, for boys or girls, is part of this larger issue, frankly, that is coming up in Baltimore right now.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's, you know, kind of the key point on this study that I was struck by is how deep the problem goes. It's not merely an issue of we just need to want to give girls more opportunities. You know, it's not that simple. It's that we have to figure out the funding and the money and the disparities. You know, high school sports aren't necessarily cheap, but they have value and they're beneficial. And, you know, bringing our schools more into line writ large should help address this problem. But I think, you know, to go back to the point about how can sports have an impact, I think this is one way, showing where they do and showing where you can highlight the segregation and the disparities in funding that exist in the sports context in a way that everyone sort of has a little bit more of understanding about, and show the way that the ways that giving those opportunities benefits everyone. I mean, the numbers on health and economics and long-term wages and the additional education that girls who participate in sports have, those benefits are amazing and have been one of the greatest legacies of Title IX and the effort to bring equality into education and through that into scholastic sports. I think it makes it really imperative that we address this problem because, you know, it's not merely an issue for all girls writ large. There's a lot of talk, obviously, in politics these days about wage gaps. Black women and Hispanic women suffer that even greater than white women do. So you look at the wage effects of playing sports in high school and having those opportunities, the education effects that then lead to higher wages, the better health effects that can do that. You know, it's all kind of tied in to larger conversations we're having. And it goes back to the fact that none of this exists in a vacuum. There are these large issues, and sports at times can give us a way to see into them and sometimes see a way out of them.
Yeah, the timing of your work last week was, I don't know if serendipitous is the right word. I don't think it is, but I'd certainly love for you to do some sort of specific follow-up on your reporting from last week and tie it into the specific issues that plague the city of Baltimore and other cities like that, because specific cities, you know, right, not just as a whole, but specific cities, because that is so much of the underlying problem in a place like Baltimore right now, as you talked about. But I suggest everyone who's listening give your article from last week on Think Progress a read through, because it does illuminate many of the issues that are the underlying causes for this tension in Baltimore today. Before I let you go, Travis, I just wanted to ask you quickly. This is a little bit of a lighter issue to send you away with. You are a Louisville. Did I pronounce that right? Louisville.
Okay. Yeah.
Louisville. You are a Louisville, Kentucky native, which that means you must have an opinion on the upcoming Kentucky Derby. So rather than ask you about who's going to win, because I don't know any of the horses, I don't know if you know any of the horses by name, but rather than ask you who's going to win, oh wait, I do know. What is the? No, I don't. I'm not even going to embarrass myself. Oh wait, no, American Pharoah. Is that right? Yeah, that's right. I'm going to ask you, what is it like to be in Louisville during the Derby week? I mean, does the city just shut down? Is it like a Mardi Gras type week-long celebration? Just give us a sense for what it's like to be in Louisville during Derby week.
Right. It's two. So Derby week, Derby in Louisville is actually more of a 2-week festival. Right. It starts with Thunder over Louisville, which is one of the biggest fireworks shows in the world, I think. two Saturdays before Derby. So that was last Saturday.
Thunder over Louisville.
Thunder over Louisville, yeah. And then there is a there's a marathon and a half marathon on the Saturday before Derby. There's a big parade, a Pegasus parade. The Pegasus is the official kind of mascot symbol of the Derby Festival. There's different events and parties and everything all over the city all week. It's kind of, you know, Louisville's kind of a weird city. It's a kind of a very localized city, and a lot of people who are there are from there. They stay there. Derby week is kind of our come party with us week. But, you know, it's funny that you know, a lot of people take off work on Friday, which is Oaks Day. That's the kind of the Derby for Phillies. That used to be Louisville's kind of day at the track. A lot of people in the city don't really go to Churchill Downs on Derby Day. You're more likely to go to Derby parties at friends' houses or family houses or around town because it's such a spectacle down around the track. But, you know, it's a fun event, and it's kind of the 1-2 week period of each year where the world spotlight, or the at least the national spotlight, is on the city where I grew up in, and it's fun. There's a connection there. I always miss home most during Derby week because yeah. I see so many pictures, yeah. And you know it's a great, you know, for all of horse racing's issues and problems, you know, it's something that ties the whole state of Kentucky together and ties the whole city of Louisville together. And it's a really fun, interesting, it's almost impossible to describe. It's such a spectacle and such a wide ranging, weird thing that it's, you know, you really, I don't know that you can really get an accurate picture of it until you're there and you see it up close.
Will you be wearing a funny hat on Saturday?
I probably will not be, but I might break out like a seersucker suit or something ridiculous and just sit at home and watch the Derby. So,
okay. Well,
by the way, my pick, I know you didn't ask, but I think my pick to win is Dortmund.
Dortmund.
So
that was the other one I heard of.
Right. Dortmund. I'm going purely on pictures. I don't know anything about gambling horses, but
I go on the odds. It's easy to bet on the front runner.
Right.
But you try to find those sweet odds somewhere between 15 to 1 to 25 to 1. You want those sweeter odds, right?
Yeah. The thing is a lot of handicappers even will tell you that betting the Derby is really hard because it's a 20 horse field, and you know, these horses have never run in a field that big. They've never run this distance. They've never run in front of a crowd this big. So it's, you know, you're kind of spitting in the wind at even making a guess. And that's especially true when you're like me and you really only follow the biggest horse races of each year and don't really know how to handicap or how to bet these things. But it's fun.
It's also a fantastic excuse every year to relearn how to make a mint julep.
Exactly. It's the one time of year where I'd actually drink one.
Okay. Travis Waldron, reporter, blogger from thinkprogress.org. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you. It's great.